There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It's our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits of today's show from Sunday, November the 17th. We look at how Generation Z is affecting emeritization strategies.
We've been getting a lot of details about a new initiative that was launched in September here in the UAE, where His Highness Sheikh Mohammed outlined. In one of these letters, basically, we had a couple of big letters, didn't we, as we came into the last quarter of the year, a bit of housekeeping, a number of directives and open letters that were issued. One of them was around emeritisation, and it included 10 resolutions to support emeritisation in the UAE. One of the things to come out of that has been a pledge for 20,000 job opportunities and a massive training fund. We've been speaking this morning to one of the women working at the front line of that, Mariam Al-Falahi, Director of the Emiratization Initiative at the Executive Council of Dubai. And she was in the studio talking about what's going to happen to create those 20,000 jobs and what the private sector was going to have to do to effectively usher in Emiratization 2.0.
We met with the companies over the last couple of weeks, and we opened a dialogue and we said the numbers could be better in the private sector when it comes to recruiting and attracting Emiratis from Dubai. The success of emiratization campaign hinges on how much commitment we see from the companies in the private sector. And we wanted to see how could we attract a bigger number to be employed in the private sector. And the answer was the challenges that we faced are numerous. However, the first probably would be, where do we find Emiratis? How do we attract the right talent? Who are they? And that's what's exactly has been done in the Executive Council. We sent a survey link a couple of days ago, and it was out and about for about 10 days. It was targeting Dubai Emiratis to come forward and fill it up, where we asked about preferences. Where do you see yourself in the private sector? What sector specifically? But also, what is it that you look in a job to be attracted to it? So we wanted to be in the middle. It's a triangular model. It's government, private sector, and then the job seeker himself. And the specific role we want the private sector to play is to be more responsible with numbers. It's a numbers game. We want them to look actively for Emiratis, work closely with the government sector, because today we have a database where we can easily see where are the Emiratis in terms of their educational qualifications and where do they want to go next. So we can help them do the matching in the shortest time frame.
And one of the areas that we thought Emiratis and Saudis would like to go next would be the hospitality sector. And we've spoken this morning to Alex Kiriakides, president of Marriott International for the Middle East and Africa region, to ask exactly that. What are they doing to attract more into the hospitality sector?
Well, it's exactly the reason why we started about 3 years ago with a program, a trial balloon in the kingdom called Tahsin, which is now spread across five countries, Kingdom, Egypt, UAE, Bahrain and Oman, to respond to nationalization, which we wholeheartedly support. That's the answer, ultimately, is that nationals of the country welcoming guests into that country. And this program was aimed to make hospitality attractive to Gulf nationals as a legitimate employment career, both for men and women. And when we got this started 3 years ago in the kingdom, we were holding our breath to see what responses we'll have, because we did it with Cornell, and we're doing it with Cornell, whereby 12 months from joining the program, the graduate comes out with certification from Marriott and Cornell and a job guaranteed at a managerial level in one of our hotels. And lo and behold, we had 50 applications, half of which were women, which for us was enormously pleasing. And the ball has started, this little snowball has started rolling. And since across these five countries now, we have 300 graduates going through the program. We would like to have a lot more. And since launching it in Egypt, we're doing it with Helwan University, a lot of support from the government. I was delighted to hear the speaker this morning announced not only the fund, but the intention of partnering private sector, because that's what we would love to see. we can double the number of graduates going through the system if there was support from governments in the form of co-funding or other initiatives to ensure that the burden, if you like, the financial burden is shared. And we're very excited. I will certainly follow up on the invitation and see if we can actually get something going here in the UAE.
Alex Kyriakidis of Marriott talking about emiratization, Saudiization, and so on.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Starting with bicycles.
How could I forget to mention the bicycle is a good invention? Sitting there in a silent movie beside the only girl who really ever knew me.
Bicycle's a good invention.
Brilliant.
And congratulations to the Red Hot Chili Peppers who are providing the soundtrack to the Business Breakfast with their various transport-related ditties.
Yeah, there you go. Cream, moving into the bike space in quite a deal with the RTA. This is what we know is going to happen. They're basically going to bring in bikes with docking stations that will be in a number of areas around Dubai. They're going to start off with 1,700 bikes just over for the first 2 years, and which will be installed in 175 different docking stations, solar powered docking stations, around the Emirate. Over the next 5 years, the number of bikes is going to double, bringing us to 3,500, and the number of docking stations will double as well. They're going to be, to start with, in key areas of the Dubai Water Canal, Jumeirah, Dubai Marina, and some of the older areas as well, Karama, Al Qusais, and Deira.
Okay. The obvious question that we all have is bicycle lanes. I mean, I was up in Mushrif Park yesterday, bicycle lanes all around, which is fabulous. That would be perfect for a nice bike ride.
Well, but I was down and walking both sides of the creek with friends on Friday, and a bike would have come in very handy, I can tell you, certainly on the second leg. But there were no bicycle lanes. You'd be cycling through the traffic, and that's the issue, isn't it, Rich?
It is.
Well, that's one of two issues for me. Two questions, really, because we don't know what is being put in place. One is bike lanes, and one is helmets. Because in Dubai, it is actually mandatory to wear a helmet if you are on a cycle. So if you are using these bikes, and one of the things that they're being set up for, Kareem has said, is for last mile, basically. So, you know, you get off the metro, you still need to get home, you grab one of these bikes, presumably a lot of the docking stations will be around places like metro stations, you can ride the bike home. Ditto, you know, if you've been on the tram or what have you, first and last mile kind of thing. Will you necessarily be carrying a helmet with you, or will they in some way provide helmets? And if so, how does that work?
And will the helmet stay attached to the bike? That's the thing, isn't it? Because they're going to disappear.
A lot of other countries have come up with different helmet solutions, so it's not undoable. There were a group of, and I want to say school kids, that invented a helmet which was effectively made out of corrugated cardboard a couple of years ago, which they found to have the same protective qualities as the traditional sort of shell.
An old Rice Krispies packet. Brilliant.
It was based on something to do with the triangle being the strongest shape. I can remember reading about it and thinking that's really, really clever. But the idea was that these things could be dispensed from a small vending machine. They could fold up, you know, and go into your handbag. So there are absolutely ways to do it. There is, by the way, a fine in Dubai, apparently, for people who use pedestrian footpaths rather than riding in the road. So if you endanger pedestrians, you can get fined here in Dubai for doing so. So, yeah, will there be bike lanes as well? More questions at the moment coming from us. Also really keen to hear what they're going to be charging for this, and also how they're going to work the drop-off bit. For example, are you just leaving the bike outside your front door for when you need it in the morning?
And of course, one of the other big questions is it's an 8-month business, really. You're not going to get much business in the summer. And Singapore has had this problem where people just leave them anywhere. They're not at drop-off stations and they're hard to go and collect.
Well, we spoke to the guys from Kareem about this not so long ago. Bassem Al-Nahlawi is the managing director for the Gulf at Kareem. He was speaking to us a few weeks ago, working on the project back then. This is what he told us.
Kareem's super excited about entering the micro-mobility space. And that focuses purely on the shorter trips. We're talking about anywhere from 0 to 3 kilometers. We call those last mile trips. And in a place like Dubai, you know, where you have this metro that goes from across the city, there's always a problem with the last mile. You get to the metro station, you get off the metro station, you still have that 1 kilometer. It could be a walk usually you're doing, or even taking a taxi. And what micromobility will do, it'll close that gap for a very, very affordable price. So we're super excited about this. And, you know, these bikes are pedal assisted, which means you don't have to put the same effort you put in a mechanical bike. A couple of, and it starts moving and helps you get there a lot quicker.
It's got a little bit of a motor in there.
Kind of, yes.
They're not going to allow it on the Tour de France, but it's okay going from the Dubai Mall metro station. That's the voice of Basil Al-Nahlawi, Managing Director of Kareem in the Gulf.
And 3 kilometres is quite a long way when you actually have to cycle it, to be honest with you. Right, I've been looking at EK2019.
That sounds like a made-up flight.
It is a made-up flight. You're actually bang on, Rich. Yesterday, Emirates says it's going to operate a one-off A380 flight on November the 29th. Called EK2019. And what they're going to try and do is get as many different nationalities aboard as possible. Special journey. They're going to fly around the UAE. Well, it doesn't actually say they're going to fly. I presume they're not going to put it in a truck and drive it, but they are going to go around the UAE on this wonderful A380. Because we've got 200 nationalities here in the UAE. And Emirates, do you have any idea how many different nationalities Emirates employs?
Oh, 160.
Well done. Yeah, over 160, in fact. So we can register. If you want to go, you can go on to emirates.com and register. You've got to give your nationality, obviously. So if you're in one of the bulk nationalities, if you're sort of Indian or Pakistani or Filipino, you're going to have a less chance because they want to get as many different nationalities on as possible. So if you're a Zairian, you might stand a better chance. So there we go. You can go on and it's for the 48th UAE National Day, of course, and we're looking very much forward to that.
Which Business Breakfast presenter are we nominating to represent the United Kingdom? Or perhaps even the Bahamas, Brandy Scott? There won't be many. But Bahamians? Bajans?
Bahamian. No, Bajan is Barbadian.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, I think New Zealand, though.
Yeah. There's half of New Zealand's here.
Half of New Zealand is definitely outside of New Zealand.
There'll be some sort of Pacific Islands, if you're from one of those. You stand a good chance, I reckon.
I think we've got two Bahamians. There's you and there's that bloke who owns the restaurants. With the brilliant accent.
That's right, yes. He is from the Bahamas as well.
Nominated. Can you go online and nominate someone else? Or do you have to nominate yourself? Do you need your Emirates ID number? I have been looking at an economic headline this morning. Why ghosts, ghouls and spectres are haunting the global economy. And that's because I caught up back end of last week with Stephen King, not the horror writer, but the guy who is senior economic advisor to HSBC. He was the chief economist there for a while. And his latest economic analysis is very, very ghostly and ghouly. This is me talking to Stephen and him explaining why he's using this ghostly, haunting metaphor to describe the state of the global economy.
Yeah, of course. So it's ghosts, spooks and spectres. It's the ghosts of deflation. It's the spooks of isolationism. And it's the spectres of recession. So it's all very cheerful. But these are the things that I think are haunting us at the moment.
So let's dig into those in a little bit more detail. What are they and what do they mean?
So a lot of people said before the global financial crisis that the West would never enter into a sort of Japan-style lost decade. But that's precisely what we've had. The ghosts of deflation have haunted the West as much as they've haunted Japan. Low growth, low productivity gains, poor demographics, very low interest rates, and of course very, very low inflation. So the kinds of conditions that you used to think were uniquely Japanese have now come through in Europe and to a certain degree in the US too.
That's Stephen King. He's senior economic advisor to HSBC.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
So as we mentioned, the air show begins shortly. Damien Ellicott is Vice President of Airport Operations Control Centre at Dubai Airports. And in simple terms, that means he is one of the people trying to make it all happen. Damien, thanks for joining us here.
It is a pleasure.
So in terms of the challenge, the logistical and operational challenge of putting something like this together, what are the biggest ones that you face?
The biggest consideration is clearly around safety. We want this air show to be one of the safest that we could possibly prepare for in the world. So safety is a prime consideration. There's a large amount of work that goes on in the preceding weeks and months to make sure that we have all the safety cases and risk assessments complete, and we have all the regulatory approvals to run the air show.
So you've got 1,300 companies going to be exhibiting at the moment. How does that break down in terms of the ones that we all know? Boeing and Airbus, of course, are going to be there. The big airlines, Etihad, Emirates, are going to be there. But how does it break down?
It breaks down, as you mentioned, there are the OEMs, the equipment manufacturers, commercial aircraft and military aircraft. Then you'll have the other parts of the supply chain for those primary manufacturers of aircraft, as well as the airlines and of course, a whole tier, many other tiers of service providers and parts of that chain.
And there's a lot of military there as well, isn't there? Which I guess brings its own headaches. You're probably more used up at DWC and DXB to having commercial aircraft, but there's going to be fighter jets there. I think, is there an F-15 or an F-11 coming?
F-35, I think.
F-35, an F-something anyway. You've got Edge, which is the new company from down the road in Abu Dhabi. They're going to be displaying a lot of military hardware. I mean, how do you manage that?
Yes, the military participation is significant, and we're very proud to partner and showcase those military aircraft, whether they be from the UAE and from the region or from other participating militaries from around the world. And we spend a lot of time, our teams up at DWC in preparation for the air show and running the air show over the next week. I spend a lot of time liaising with the MOD or General Headquarters of the UAE's military to make sure that we can manage the safety effectively, as well as liaise most effectively with them and put on a great flying show of military aircraft.
Talking of safety, it's obviously to see the sort of things that might happen at an air show. Static planes on the ground pretty much, but things that move in the sky are obviously a risk. And we see that the GCAA or the DCA has closed the airspace around the DWC for drones for 15 kilometres, I think it is, around it. How big an issue could they be?
Well, clearly anything that would infringe into the airspace during the air show could be a risk. It could distract one of the pilots that is displaying during the air show, and ultimately could be a collision risk. So during any air show in any part of the world, then the airspace is designated and sterilized for the period of time during the air show so that the pilots can run their displays safely.
The very economics of an air show, in fact, all trade shows, we had the motor show in Dubai last week, is being called into question. What shows in Switzerland are being called into question? Because for exhibitors, it's incredibly expensive to showcase their wares. And in an era of social media, many are questioning whether they need to do that, whether it's a $10,000 watch or a $100 million aircraft. What kind of conversations are you having with those 1,300 exhibitors about the cost of exhibiting at an air show, and how are you trying to keep it down?
Well, this is one of the biggest air shows in the world, and the exhibitors, I think, are that clearly they're very keen to participate. It's a show that over the years has been a huge showcase for the aircraft manufacturers. There have been significant deals announced over those years. Let's see what this week brings, but I think those conversations are fairly straightforward because it's got such a high place on the list of world air shows that participants are there and keen to participate.
I mean, Dubai is a smaller air show than Paris and Farnborough, but it's traditionally had big deals coming up here simply because we've got a lot of homegrown airlines in the region. Do you expect, given what's going on at the moment, for it to be a slightly quieter show in terms of deals?
I don't think that's really something that I would want to comment on. I think it will be a great show in terms of showcasing aircraft, the static aircraft on the ground, the flying display itself. Given the global conditions and the aviation market at the moment, I think we just have to wait and see what happens in terms of the deals that might be announced this week. But fingers crossed for some good news.
Well, it sounds like a great show, and I'm looking forward to it. We just heard one of the pilots from the Blades Aeropatic show. They're going to be there. Lots of people want to go, but most people can't go. Mirinda writes in, please ask your guest, that'll be you, Damien, why the public is not allowed to attend the air show and things like the aerobatic displays. We used to love it years ago, but we can't anymore.
It's always been a trade show and hasn't been open to the public yet. Certainly, it's something which, as a former Red Arrows pilot myself, and knowing how much joy and how much that the crowds like to see the flying displays, that in the future perhaps it's a possibility. But unfortunately, for the time being, it's a trade show. I'm sure the displays will be visible from a lot of parts of Dubai, those close to DWC. But perhaps that's something that we need to look at in the future.
Well, Malcolm mentioned the Shoreham disaster 4 years ago. Now, this was a crash in the United Kingdom. It was an air show. A plane crashed and a number of people on the ground were killed. And partly as a result of that, even Farnborough in the UK, which always used traditionally did have public days, they've cancelled them, haven't they? So I guess the way the wind is blowing in the air show space is, unfortunately for Miranda, it's against public coming to visit rather than towards it.
As I mentioned at the beginning, and I opened it, that safety is the primary concern when organising an air show. Naturally, when you have aircraft flying in close formation or solo at high speed close to the public, then there is risk, and that's what we have to manage through our teams and with the organisation and regulation, which we do very, very well.
I mean, we're lucky up at DWC to have quite a lot of open space here. And the last air show I was at was the Bournemouth air show. And they've now, in the last couple of years, been forced to sort of push their displays over the sea rather than having it over land. Do you think that's the way that air shows might go in future?
Well, potentially, it's certainly something which alleviates some of the risk that we would otherwise have somewhere like Farnborough or other venues where the show could be over built up areas. Bournemouth, other coastal destinations, which Ben and myself displayed out in the Red Arrows, were fantastic locations because it gave the crowds a great spectacle while minimising the risk. Up at the air show, we have the Flying Control Committee, which is established, which comprises a number of experts from the sector who are there to supervise the show, monitor the displays, and to make sure that everything runs as safely as possible.
We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Damien Ellicott of Dubai Airports. Good luck with the air show. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
What's the prize if you win the Nobel Laureate for something or other? How much do you get?
A million? You get a load of money.
$1 million or something, isn't it? This is not that sort of magnitude of prize for our weekend quiz. I have two chocolate bars. Well, not bars, they're health bars, I suppose. One is almond and coconut, and one is dark chocolate, nuts and sea salt. That is the prize. Are you up for it? Big stakes.
Dark chocolate, nuts and sea salt. Yeah.
Well, you can share them if you want. Right, here we go. The weekend quiz. What happened? London shares fell on Friday as the Labour Party in Britain said it would nationalise what? Airports, newspapers or the internet? Shout at once.
The internet.
It was BT Openreach, the internet.
I have a funny feeling that we might be sharing this because I think you're going to get 5 out of 5 on this.
I don't want the buzz. I want a week worth of lattes.
You want to eat what, sorry?
I want you to pay for my coffee for a week.
For a week?
Yeah.
This is not, I told you, this is not the Nobel Laureate, Bradley Scott. Who displayed a massively intricate 38-by-7-metre model railway system? Richard Dean, anyone? Built by himself over the duration of his career. Russian President Vladimir Putin, singer Rod Stewart or cricketer Shane Warne?
Dennis Waterman.
It was indeed, yes. Yeah. No, it was singer Rod Stewart.
Pete Waterman. Fantastic. No, he was the model railway man, not Dennis Waterman.
Two for two. I told you you were going to be sharing these.
Did you see the pictures of it?
I know. Wasn't it brilliant?
Wasn't it? And I'm not a model railway person, but it was
real.
Fantastic.
It was. Have you seen pictures, Rich?
No.
It was like a real city.
It was based on a New Yorkie-type Chicago from the year that Rod Stewart was born, which I want to say is 1949, but I could be wrong.
1900s, anyway.
1952, something like that. Anyway, but the intricacy and the details of... forget the trains. It was the buildings.
But the trains come ready-made, kind of. He made all the buildings. It's fantastic.
It's a city.
But the reason this all came to light is because one radio station was saying, when they saw the pictures of this, well, he can't have done all that. He might have done something. And he rang the radio station to say, I did 90% of it. The only thing I was rubbish at was the electricals. I got someone in to do the electricals. Otherwise, it was all me. So well done to Rod Stewart. Anyway, that's 2 for 2.
He took little bits of it on tour. And did it in his hotel room.
That's right. His hobby.
Whenever he was in a hotel room when he was touring, he got an extra hotel room, which they'd set up special ventilation. Presumably, there's lots of sort of smelly glue and stuff involved, so that he could go in there and work on it in between concerts. And he said if he hadn't done that, he never would have managed to do it.
Living the rock and roll high life, eh? And now, number three, as the finale of Brexit approaches, the EU in Brussels is suing the UK. What for? For 45 years back royalties on EU cheese and butter sales, for electing a new commissioner to the EU, despite leaving it, for not electing a new commissioner to the EU despite leaving it. A, B or C?
Objection. I disagree with the premise of the question. You say we're reaching the finale of Brexit.
Yes, well, okay, yes, okay, fair enough. A, B or C?
Do you know, I actually don't know. I'm going to go with C.
I'm going to go with B.
It is indeed C, for not electing. You'd think that they wouldn't really care as Britain's about to leave, but they are suing the UK for not electing a new commissioner. So you said B, did you, Brandy? Richard?
I'm afraid so.
Yeah, so that's a Brandy question. Right, number four, just two to go. Qantas has just completed another record-breaking test flight. This time on Thursday, they flew 19 and a half hours from London to Sydney, non-stop, part of their birthday celebration, 50 people on board. I want to know, how old is the airline? 59, 79 or 99 years old? If you saw a picture of the plane, you'll know.
I didn't actually. Where are we
59,
now?
59, 79 or
90? Definitely 59 years old.
I'm going to go with the middle one, Sit B.
It's 99 years old. They have Qantas 100 painted on the side, and this is their 100th year of existence, 100th birthday in a few months' time. And lastly, so nobody, I stayed at the Sheraton on the Creek over the weekend. The hotel was open.
What did Malcolm have for breakfast?
Yes, yeah, so in 1997, the hotel was opened by whom? A, Queen Elizabeth II, B, Demis Roussos, or C, President Jimmy Carter?
It was, again, I questioned the premise of the question. I don't think it was opened in 1997, but it was
1977.
Oh, I thought you said 1997.
No, 1977.
Definitely QE2.
Yeah, I'll go with Queen Elizabeth.
You're both right. It is indeed Queen Elizabeth II. And that means Brandy wins 5-4. You got a sweep, Brandy.
Hang on,
Scott,
it wasn't
well
5-4.
Yes,
it was
you got
a much wider. I mean,
oh, it's 4-3 because we both got the Qantas thing wrong.
I don't think Richard got three right.
Anyway, it doesn't matter, Brandy Scott. You win the chocolate bars, all of them.
And it also doesn't matter because I'm off the sugar, so effectively Richard
ends up... Do you want to give them to Richard?
Richard's the winner. Chocolate bars anyway.
Well, it's a festive season, so hashtag regifting is becoming a bit of a thing. I was actually down by the creek on Thursday night. I didn't stay there, but it was design week. Coming to an end, and we took a couple of journalists from out of town, and they said we want to see, you know, not just the, you know, swanky hotels, but, you know, what's a nice bit of Dubai to take us to. So we went down to one of the hotels actually opposite the Sheraton on the Bir Dubai side, and sat there, yeah, had a drink, had a walk by the creek.
Upstairs by the pool, was it?
It was upstairs by the pool. You
nice
know
view
it.
There.
You
yeah.
know it well. Lovely yeah. view. And then we took them to, I know it's a cliche, but we took them to Ravi's in Saturday.
I know, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they enjoy it?
They were very happy. Yeah, yeah. They were very, very happy tourists.
Perfect weather.
You mentioned Rod Stewart and his railway, and I was looking at it, and it seems inconceivable that an aging rocker like that could have made something so intricate. But this is a producer, Shruti and Milani, have dug out an interview he gave over the weekend about this model railway. And this is what he said.
To tell you, my wife called and she said they're talking about your model railroad and insinuating that you didn't build it all yourself. Well, so that's the reason I rang in.
I was worried about that. The reason I insinuated that is because it's so enormous, I didn't believe you could have built it single-handedly.
Yeah, I would say 90% of it I built myself. The only thing I wasn't very good at, and still I'm not, is the electricals. So that I had someone else do that.
What a cracking achievement. If you go and have a look, if you haven't seen pictures of Rod Stewart's model railway, go online and check it out.
Even I think it's amazing. The best thing about that interview is afterwards Jules Holland rung up and began talking about his model railway.
You're listening. If you built a model railway over the weekend, get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning live on air from 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.